fire and ice. It's all about the extremes.
The radiant heat coming out of this wall of flame was about 900 Fahrenheit.
These glacial fjords were carved during ice ages when the glaciers expanded.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. From Canadian wildfires to Greenland's ice sheet, stories today about the changing environment and people trying to do something about it.
Like this tree vigilante in Mexico City.
We'll help this tree that is very stressed, he says.
And scientists racing to save starfish from a deadly bacteria.
And actually their arms fall off and walk away from their body.
The arms walk away.
The arms walk away. The sea star walks away too.
Don't worry, there is hope for the sea star and for the rest of us.
That's all coming up today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Glad you're spending part of the long Thanksgiving weekend with us. Today's show is about something a lot of us are grateful for, our natural world. It's also cause for concern. So this hour on the show, we're going to return to some of the most consequential stories from the environment beat of the past year.
We begin with the good news. In the first half of this year, more of the world's electricity came from solar and wind power than from coal.
Raul Miranda helped carry out that research with the climate think tank Ember in the UK. When we spoke this fall, he explained what's been driving the trend.
I mean, the short answer will be, you know, technology, the cost and momentum. And solar and wind have become the cheapest forms of new power in most parts of the world. And every new project sort of makes the next one cheaper, creating an interesting cycle of growth. While with fossil fuels, essentially you have a stable cost, or at least actually even increasing cost, because the more you extract fossil fuels from the ground, the more expensive they become. So you have different trends in terms of cost, you know, one going down while the other tend to go up.
Where is this shift to renewable energy happening the most dramatically, and what parts of the world still rely heavily on fossil fuels for power?
Yes, we have China and India as main ones. You know, we've seen in these two countries, you know, solar really outpacing fossil fuel and particularly coal generation. But that's not only a story for China and India. We've seen the same in Brazil. We've seen the same in Southeast Asia, Pakistan. So there has been really a global momentum and a global movement towards renewables and having renewables and being cheaper and outpacing fossil fuel generation.
I mean, you mentioned the technology. I mean, China is the world's largest producer of solar panels, and I'm guessing that gives them significant home production advantage. But specifically in China and India, what's happening in those countries that explains these changes?
China led global clean energy growth in the first semester of this year, so adding more solar and wind power than the rest of the world combined, so essentially cutting fossil fuel generation in that country. And the fossil fuel use in China is sort of, you know, starting to achieve a plateau. In India, the clean growth outpaced demand by more than three times, which means that the new renewable generation outpaced also the new increase in demand. By outpacing demand, that means that you now have renewables also being able to, you know, fill in the electricity generation that once was met by fossil fuels.
I'm curious, with this embrace of renewables in China and India, are they also still burning coal, but just at a reduced rate?
Yes, that's correct. Even if you see eventually that in some countries, you eventually see that they are still, you know, building new coal generation, that means that some of this new coal, they are essentially being used for fewer moments in the year, but not at a flat, stable generation across the year.
Do you think this recent rise in renewables is going to continue, or is it just a blip in the bigger story?
Yeah, specifically in the U.S., solar and wind indeed couldn't keep up that rise in electricity demand in that country. So essentially coal stepped up to fill in that gap. In the EU, we had last year and also this year weaker wind and hydro, which meant that gas and coal generation had to rise again, ultimately leading again to the slight increase in emissions. So we have different stories in these two countries and Europe. We may still see, you know, these moments where fossil fuels may eventually still increase, but the overall global trend, it goes in the opposite direction, actually fossil fuels going down.
Raul Miranda is with Ember, a climate think tank in the UK. He spoke with us this fall from Rio de Janeiro.
And stay with us later this hour for a look at when Britain phased out coal and the deep repercussions that had.
Mexico City has been implementing a plan to reduce air pollution by planting trees. We're talking tens of millions of trees. And when the city's trees face threats to their survival, activists step in to defend them, as we heard from the world's TBS Isaiah in Mexico City.
On a recent morning, activist Arturo Hernandez shows up in front of a restaurant in Mexico City and starts a Facebook Live transmission. Once again, the tree army is at work, he says. I am Commander Hernandez. He's not exactly a commander, and his army is just a few volunteers, but they have a big mission: to protect Mexico City's trees. He points to his new target. We'll help this tree that is very stressed, he says, pointing to an ash whose roots have been completely covered with a thick layer of cement. Hernandez is trying to find out who did this, and he suspects it was the restaurant managers to make space for delivery motorbikes to park here. He asks around, but he's mostly ignored by restaurant employees. The neighbors also say they don't know who's responsible, so he and his army decide to break up the concrete with sledgehammers to free the tree's roots. He invites a few bystanders to help smash the concrete.
Por favor, caballero.
Please, gentlemen, would you like to join, he asks. You can liberate stress and help nature, Hernandez says. His video got over 10 million views. He built a big following after years of posting humorous videos about civic engagement, and he started getting complaints from his followers about vandalized trees. He says there are many companies, real estate agencies, and even neighbors who see trees as an obstacle, as garbage. But they usually don't stop him. They just question why he's doing this. Carmen Dominguez is an arborist who frequently attends Commander Hernandez's events. She says pouring concrete over the tree's roots prevents them from absorbing water and nutrients. Trees are essential assets, especially in a polluted place like Mexico City with some 22 million residents. Dominguez says it's also common the illegal removal of too much foliage from the trees, which can make them more susceptible to disease and even death. Weeks later, Hernandez shows up to a famous local coffee shop chain, which opened a new store. He takes a megaphone and denounces the company that ordered the removal of large branches out of four trees to make space for a new sign. The tree army wants you to know that this coffee shop is ecocidal, says Commander Hernandez. He got lawyers involved in this case, but they say it can take years to get a resolution, which will likely be just a fine of about $2,000 for the cafe company. Commander Hernandez says this is frustrating, but for now, his main goal is to educate Mexico City's residents. If we can't take care of the trees in our sidewalk, he says, we'll never be able to save the Amazon. For the world, I'm TBS Isaiah, Mexico City.
Sea stars, also known as starfish, saw plummeting numbers this year along North America's west coast. 90% of the sunflower sea star population had already died off before scientists finally figured out why. A bacteria had been killing them. Scientist Alyssa Gaiman was on the team behind this discovery, and to help us appreciate how significant it was, she gave us some Starfish 101.
They're these amazing animals. They live on the bottom of the ocean floor. Most of them have five arms, but actually the sunflower star that we study starts with five when it's a baby and then just keeps popping out arms until it gets up to around 24 arms.
Wow. How
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So it really matters that these populations were decimated because the starfish is what's called a keystone species, which means it's really important for the rest of the ecosystem. Can you tell me about that and what happened when these things started disappearing?
So sunflower stars, they eat almost everything that lives on the bottom of the ocean. Like, there's a bunch of different animals that have escape responses from them, like sea urchins, which are these little spiky animals, run away from them, you know, all at relatively slow speeds for our eyes, but they're running. And urchins, when they don't have something eating them, it turns out their populations just boom. And then those urchins eat kelp. And so when we got so many more urchins than they used to be, we started to lose the kelp forests. Mm. And we didn't, in fact, know how important sunflower stars were to controlling the urchin populations until we lost them.
And then kelp forests, in turn, are like the nurseries for a bunch of other marine species. And they're also a big carbon sink, right?
Yeah. They also help sort of dissipate waves from storms. They're incredibly important ecosystems.
So when was it first noticed that these sea stars were succumbing to this mystery disease? And what did that look like?
Yeah, the first observations were in 2013. And what they saw were animals twisting their arms. So the sea stars normally sort of have their arms out straight, and they started to twist back around their body. And they start to get lesions. And actually, eventually, their arms sort of fall off and walk away from their body.
The arms walk away.
The arms walk away. The sea star walks away, too. It's really gruesome. And you know, if you're diving, you might actually see just a couple of arms, and then you'll see the rest of the sea star a few feet away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It sounds a little bit underwater apocalyptic.
Yeah, it's awful. And it's really stark, because these sea stars really, especially up and down the coast on the West Coast, are just, they used to be everywhere. And so as you're watching them die, it looks different to be underwater when they're gone.
All right. So you have led this research that has discovered what is doing this to this species. Tell us how you discovered that this bacteria is causing this wasting disease.
We started with a sick animal. And we collected tissues, and in some cases, importantly, we collected their body fluid, so kind of like it's similar to blood. And we did controlled exposures in the lab. And so what we found was incredibly clear. All of the ones we exposed to what we thought might have live pathogen in it, they all died, or almost all of them died, really 95%. And what we found was in those exposed animals, just tons of Vibrio pectinocyta. It would make up like 80% of what was in their body fluid, and none in the controls. Mm,
a clear picture there that this is what was causing this wasting disease, which must be very gratifying as a scientist, but in and of itself does not help protect these animals. Are there steps that can be taken now to stop the spread of this bacteria?
There are. So there are people on the ground just immediately able to respond to this new piece of information. So with these new tools, maybe we can start to find individuals that are resistant to this pathogen and maybe raise those. We can also look for probiotics and maybe phages, which is a virus that attacks bacteria. And that can be used to help the sea star fight off this disease. We can also screen populations in the wild to see how much of Vibrio pectinocyta is out there and try and find places where there's very little. And maybe that's where we try and focus our recovery efforts. That's sort of just the beginning of things that we can do. There's a lot we can do now.
Alyssa Gaiman is a scientist with the Hakai Institute and the University of British Columbia.
Renewable energy, tree vigilantes, astonishing starfish. We're looking back at some of our environmental coverage from the past year. Just ahead, the extreme conditions inside Canada's forest fires. You're with the world.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Like in many places, massive wildfires have become increasingly familiar in Canada. Last summer, several million acres of forest burned, and tens of thousands of people had to be evacuated from the paths of those fires. John Valiant knows this well. He wrote Fire Weather, which is an account of the 2016 blaze that tore through parts of northern Alberta. We talked this summer at the height of fire season.
Well, there are so many downsides to climate change, but as the atmosphere warms, it actually generates more lightning. My understanding is with every degree of warming, you get about 12% more lightning.
Wow. And so, significant.
Exactly. So you can have very remote areas in Alaska or the far north of Canada where there are simply no human beings whatsoever. And many fires can be started there by lightning. But most fires, especially around settled areas, inhabited areas, about 80% of those fires are human caused, which means a carelessly managed campfire, a hot muffler, a spark coming off a chain, you know, hanging off a bumper on the road and flying into the dry grass. You know, we are a flamboyant species, and we have a lot of fire around us all the time, and they get out of control.
Your book, Fire Weather, describes the behavior of a fire that becomes so intense it creates its own weather. I'm hoping you can kind of take us inside of a fire from when it sparks to when it sort of starts growing out of control. What is happening there?
So almost all fires start small, and it really depends on the weather conditions. Boreal forests, the northern forests of Canada and Alaska, are really the wettest biome on Earth. In spite of that, the weather conditions for Fort McMurray, Alberta, which is in northern Alberta, on May 2016, the relative humidity was 11%, and you have to go to Death Valley in the month of July to find a comparable relative humidity. So to find desertic dryness in the northern boreal after 2 years of drought, and then you break the temperature record for that day and put it up into the 90s, and then you set it on fire. And so what you have is very rapid fire spread, and that even with water bombers on it almost immediately burned out of control. And once the heat starts billowing out of that fire, it starts generating its own wind and it starts throwing the embers. But when you have radiant heat, which is the invisible heat that tells you not to touch the candle, it moves at the speed of light. And the radiant heat coming out of this wall of flame sweeping into Fort McMurray was about 900 Fahrenheit. So that's hotter than the planet Venus. And what that does is not only does it generate more wind, it desiccates everything in front of it for many hundreds of yards. Mm. So every tree, every house, everything is bone dry and then heated up past combustive temperatures. So the moment an ember lands on it, again, it doesn't just sizzle, it explodes into flame. And so houses, these are $600,000, two-story, state-of-the-art modern houses, burnt from the roof to the basement in 5 minutes.
What an intense description of those fires that you outlined in your book, Fire Weather. John, can you tell me the conditions right now in the places that are burning in Canada this year, Saskatchewan, Manitoba? Are we also seeing drought and high temperatures there?
Yeah, so there's a cumulative effect to climate change. You know, we had the hottest year in recorded history in 2024. 2023 was almost as hot as that. And as you raise the temperature of anything, you're going to have more evaporation. And we haven't had proper snowpack in years. And rivers, bogs are all evaporating much more quickly than they normally would. And so all kinds of water levels are at record lows across Western Canada. So you have this compound effect. And here's quite an interesting detail. You've heard of zombie fires,
yes,
also known as holdover fires. Mike Flanagan, a very well-respected fire scientist here in Western Canada, has observed this. And he said, you know, I've been studying this phenomenon since the 1970s, and I've never seen them make it through two winters. And so what you have then, and I talked about this in Fire Weather, is this potential future scenario where there's no longer a fire season. There's just fire.
And just to fully define here, zombie fires, they are fires that burn and never go fully out. They kind of exist underground in the soil over the winter and then can spring back up again in the summer. And what's new here is that, or what seems to be new, is that it appears these are lasting two winters now.
So they're burning almost like a coal seam fire, kind of perpetually smoldering underground. Think of the roots down there as these slow-burning fuses. And they just burn all winter long. And then when the snow cover is gone and the frost is gone, they can resurface to light up the duff and leaves and grass above them and then move into the trees.
You have written about what you call evacuation fatigue in Canada. What are you seeing?
Well, you know, one of the really heartening byproducts of these fires is this incredible community response. You know, when Fort McMurray was evacuated, almost 90,000 people were run out of there in an afternoon. You know, it was a catastrophic event socially, and it was the biggest, most rapid evacuation due to fire in modern times. And the rest of Canada opened their arms, you know, to those people. But when it keeps happening, it's very taxing to the finances, to the social capital, to just the toothpaste supplies in local stores when thousands of new people suddenly descend on a community. And while people are generous and helpful, there are limits. And so one town in Alberta, a town called High Level, has officially announced that they won't be taking in fire refugees this season because they've done it for the past couple of seasons. And it's a small community. They don't have a lot of margin. And they're basically saying, we can't handle it anymore. Hmm. And it's not because they're selfish or don't love their neighbors. It's simply because their resources are exhausted. And it's also physically exhausting, you know, looking after, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of new people who might be traumatized, are certainly disoriented and need everything because they've left everything behind.
Right. Maybe they're thinking it is another town's turn after a couple of years of this there.
Yeah. And this is another, you know, terrible test that climate change is imposing on us is, you know, we can handle disasters most of the time, but what we don't do so well is serial disasters. They're a terrible drain on every kind of resource, and they're so demanding and so violent. And then there's the trauma. Really, there's a PTSD factor.
Yeah, of course.
To these, you know, that's invisible, but that, you know, needs to be counted in terms of when we tally the costs of these events.
John Valiant is a Canadian journalist and author of Fire Weather on the Front Lines of a Burning World.
That was a stark picture of how fire behaves in a warming climate. Just ahead, Carolyn takes a close look at the mile-thick ice sheet in Greenland with scientists working nearby. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Today's show is focused on the environment, and obviously that includes climate change. If you want a clear shot that will reveal how quickly the globe is warming, go to Greenland and its mile-thick ice sheet. Part of why Greenland matters, not just to the Arctic, but to the rest of the world, has to do with a key ocean system with a terrible name, the AMOC, Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation.
That Atlantic Ocean system, the AMOC, controls the weather for a lot of the planet. And the meltwater from Greenland's glaciers might change how the system works. I got to ride along with scientists looking into it on a boat in Greenland this summer. We were on a 200-foot scientific research vessel sailing from the coast of southeast Greenland into Surmulake Fjord, essentially an inlet carved by glaciers and flanked by jagged mountains.
You can see the tall mountains on both sides. And these glacial fjords were carved during ice ages when the glaciers expanded.
Harvard oceanographer Fiamma Stranjo is the lead scientist on the ship and has been studying this fjord since 2008.
Picture this all filled with ice. And then in warmer periods, like we are now, the glaciers retreat.
Stranjo and I are standing at the bow of the ship facing a glacier in the distance they call Midgard. It looks like a river of ice flowing down from the Greenland ice sheet into the water in front of us, ending in a wall of white. This ice that we are staring at is key to the future of the AMOC.
If all of the Greenland ice sheet melts, it's safe to say that would wreak havoc on global weather systems. Is that fair?
Yes, and we don't expect the entire ice sheet to melt, but even just melting a fraction of the ice sheet and putting all of the fresh water into the ocean quickly has the ability to really affect the ocean circulation.
Here's why. The AMOC is driven by warmer surface waters near the equator moving northward. Now, as they cool, they sink to the bottom of the ocean, are carried back toward the equator, and eventually rise again.
The AMOC, this overturning circulation, is very sensitive to fresh water. So if the ocean is salty, fresh water, it's very light, it sits at the top of the ocean, and it can inhibit or completely stop this process of mixing that is part of the overturning circulation.
Greenland's ice, it is fresh water, so if it all melted and slid onto the surface of the ocean fast, it's game over for the AMOC. But it's not that simple. The meltwater doesn't just get sprayed out on top of the ocean.
It's not as simple as turning a hose on. If you can see it in the background.
She gestures to the glaciers.
Some of them are deep, thousands of feet below sea level.
Some of the meltwater actually comes out down at near the bottom of the glacier. It gets mixed in the fjord with meltwater from the top of the glacier and from icebergs.
These rivers of fresh water into the North Atlantic, if we want to understand where they're going, how quickly, at what depths, we need to measure the processes in the fjords.
That's what scientists are doing on this ship, measuring this meltwater to understand better where it is and where it's headed.
And there it goes.
PhD student Aurora Roth leans over a railing on the ship deck as she watches a large metal cage filled with water-collecting canisters get lowered into the fjord.
And the water's so clear that you can see it, like, 10 meters down.
Sensors on this instrument measure the temperature of the water and how salty it is at different depths.
And I kind of think about it as, like, spying on the ocean or eavesdropping on the ocean.
After several minutes, the instrument is pulled up out of the water, and Roth plugs a cable into a laptop to download the data.
This is the best part.
This is when the ocean spills its secrets.
On a line graph, she points to a layer of cold water about 300 feet down. It is hard to say exactly where it's coming from, Roth says.
But it definitely has glacial influence. It would not be that cold without the influence of glaciers and glacial meltwater and of icebergs melting as well.
Now, this data and 18 years of data gathered by generations of Strandjo students show that meltwater from Greenland's glaciers is making its way out of this fjord and into the North Atlantic. To understand how it and other forces are affecting the AMOC, scientists have sunk sensors farther out in the ocean that record data 24/7. Some of these sensors, called moorings, stretch from the Bahamas to Western Africa. The ones Strandjo works on are deployed off southern Greenland, stretching to Canada in one direction and Scotland in the other.
We've been measuring the flow of warm water poleward and the return flow towards the equator, so southward, for over 10 years. And so what we can do is we can link the measurements here to the AMOC measurements.
As she and I talk, Strandjo and her team are recovering a mooring they deployed here 2 years ago.
5-3-5-3-3-3-3-3-1-0.
She stands at the edge of the deck in a hard hat and life vest, working with Harvard researcher Margaret Lindman to send the mooring a signal to come to the surface.
Jakob, we are going to release the mooring.
Yes, thank you very much. Good luck.
So now we go up to the bridge to look for it. Scientists, the crew, everyone heads to an upper deck, peering out to starboard to try to spot three buoys that will float the sensor to the surface.
Roger that. We spotted it.
Yay!
All right, Tunis, you get the chocolate. Good job.
The crew fishes the mooring out of the sea. The scientists scrub off 2 years of accumulated muck. And then four scientists and one reporter huddle around a computer to watch the data transfer.
1 minute to download 2 years worth of data.
They seem excited and nervous. There is no way to be certain that the sensor has been gathering data properly until they see what is on this laptop screen.
It looks like a full record, which means 2 more years.
So is it success?
Success.
Yay! Success here means one more hard-fought data point to add to an 18-year record Stranio has been collecting about what Greenland's melting glaciers are doing to this fjord and what that might mean for the AMOC.
To understand this link, make predictions, give information that communities can use to adapt and prepare is really key. And at the same time, a reminder that we need to reduce fossil fuel emissions if we don't want our planet to absorb even more heat.
Harvard oceanographer Fiamma Stranio leading research in Greenland to understand if the AMOC, that key ocean current, is slowing down or at risk of collapsing.
The effort to reduce fossil fuels has clear upsides for the climate and environment. But in parts of the world that once were the source of those fossil fuels, change has been hard and has taken a personal toll. Reporter Dan Ashby from our partners at DW traveled around the UK to learn about the country's tough experience weaning itself off of coal. Coal was the fuel source that shaped British communities and culture for centuries. Here's Dan with that story from the UK and lessons learned there.
Here we go, road to Aberdare, getting higher, higher and higher and higher.
Hundreds of years ago, Britain provided 85% of the world's coal. It's no stretch to say, coal built the Industrial Revolution. So I'm driving back in time to understand what we've lost. I arrive at Beamish Living Museum in County Durham, an entire 1950s mining village that's been preserved with hundreds of volunteer actors living a 50s life. Pop in to the miners' cottages and you'll find a roaring coal fireplace.
It feels lovely and traditional, doesn't it?
Yes.
I can see why they say it was the centre of the home, because now I see the full fireplace in its full glory. It is quite something.
It absolutely is. I mean, you would do everything on this fire. If you didn't have this range, then basically you couldn't do your daily chores, because without the range, you've got no food and no hot water, so...
Of course, I didn't think of the water, drying clothes. I just saw it as heat. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
The point is that coal was, and still is, much more than a black rock. It shaped the way our homes are built, our culture, even gender and psychology. And if Europe wants to close its 150-odd coal mines, not to mention ending coal imports, a good start is to fully understand what coal means to coal communities, as John Kindlysides, a historian from the museum, explains.
We shouldn't bury our heads in the sand and deny that we use coal. We should celebrate the fact that this part of the region was built on the coal industry. And a lot of our towns and villages wouldn't be the same, wouldn't in a lot of cases exist without coal. Yeah, it is. It's a very emotive subject. Any ex-miner, they all mourn the loss of the coal industry.
Britain's closure of coal was at times confrontational, even brutal.
He knows that this strike, started by manipulation of union rules, has been maintained by violence and intimidation.
Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister most associated with killing coal. Her government closed more than 100 pits in a few years, sparking the iconic 1984 miners' strike.
Hands up vote, unanimously, to go on strike as from Monday morning.
I've arrived in South Yorkshire with ex-miner and ex-striker Alex Matheson. We're walking around the edges of a new housing estate, but this was once the fields of Orgreave, where the strike reached its climax. Even now, as we've just passed the 40th anniversary of that day, it's still raw. This is the first time that Alex has been back.
So there were people on the field physically fighting each other, policemen and pickets. There were missiles being thrown. But I've never seen ever in my life as much brutality from the police. My heart were in my mouth that day, because I had to run, and I could run at that time, and I had to run. Since there were no way, and I kept looking back to see who were near me, and all I could see were miners falling to the ground. I'm a bit tearful now, frightened me, honestly. that day. Wow, that were up here.
Within 10 years, 180,000 had lost their jobs, with little support or economic management. Decades on, the same areas of the UK still suffer intergenerational poverty, and communities remain divided.
Did people fall out with them?
Yeah, so people don't speak today. In some of the villages, some of them had destroyed the marriages, lost the homes.
Orgreave and the abrupt abandonment of coal communities in the 1980s has become the symbol of an unjust transition, where the poorest communities pay the price for an economic transformation. As Europe closes its coal power plants and moves to renewables, how can it avoid repeating that mistake? The good news is that already the EU has learned from the UK. The transition will be more planned, and there's funds to help coal workers transition to other industries. So the big challenge for Europe is to try to keep its coal communities engaged. There are some answers that Europe can find in the UK to all these difficult problems, not least in how the UK managed coal's decline from the noughties on. And that came down to setting a deadline and having a vision.
We're now standing in my office looking out across...
That's Graham Miller, the former council leader of the British city of Sunderland, showing off the view from the council building. Sunderland was built on coal and shipyards, but it's been voted one of the top cities in the world for climate ambition. That's in part because the UK legislated to phase out coal and subsidise the renewables market. Now Sunderland is planning to make its own electricity from wind and solar panels and to be carbon neutral by 2040.
But what you can see across to my right is the three Gen 2 tower blocks that are now using heat-sourced water to heat those buildings rather than having gas boilers in them. If you can see cranes, you're doing things. That's what people expect.
He believes that going green will bring money and jobs into Sunderland. And actually, being built on mines, because of all the water they hold, is an important part of the plan.
The water down there, if the ground conditions are right, it's about 60, 70 degrees, which is absolutely brilliant for heating houses and keeping everybody warm with a good source of hot water.
And yet, even with models like Sunderland and the UK, Europe has its work cut out. 25 countries will have phased out coal by 2030, but another 12 either won't make that deadline, or in countries like Poland, haven't got a full plan to phase it out yet. Even Germany, seen as an environmental leader, says it'll phase out coal only by 2038. The re-election of Donald Trump and the rise of the far right in Europe have both made speeding up coal's demise much trickier. And as I left Sunderland, I didn't have to travel far to find ex-miners who are already rallying against climate progress.
The dinosaurs were wiped out by?
A meteorite.
Which did what? Climate change.
I've made it to a pub in Gateshead, where I'm having an argument with ex-miner Dave Douglas.
And the species that existed before the dinosaurs were wiped out by what? Climate change.
But isn't that an argument to say we don't want it to happen again?
Of course we don't want it to happen again, but what I'm trying to say to you is we can't stop climate change. There can't be any rational debate with anybody on the subject of climate change if people think they can stop climate change.
Well, we could stop man-made climate change, surely, because that's self-evidently true.
We could if we all committed mass suicide. We could stop man-made climate change if we don't contribute anything at all. But to think you can run away from the greatest source of power in the world, we're not going to stop using fossil fuels.
The argument went on long into the evening, until I left, exhausted. Despite that, people like Dave are still in the minority. Unlike in the US over the past 30 years, the UK has cultivated that rarest of political things, a consensus. It is fragile and complicated and sometimes contested, but most people now agree coal is better left underground. In the northeast of England, ex-miner Eric Foster shows me the ropes by leading me into a dark, dank, huge drift mine, the weight of a hillside above us.
And this would have been loud, dirty, noisy, wet.
Wet. The machine itself is 10 times louder than a normal road digger.
Wow, and that's all day?
People that's all day, 8 hours a day with that machine. If you're working in there, you'll be working in there for 8 hours, lying down. When we went to school, if your father didn't work in a coal mine, there was something matter with him.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it used to be like.
And now here we are, end of coal, really. There's no big coal mines left in the UK.
We know the environmental legacy, but it's also had a big cultural, economic impact on our country. How should we remember it? Should we be glad that it's gone? Or,
well, personally, being an ex-coal miner, coal's had its day. You know, it's finished. We can just remember it. Kids don't know what coal is. They've never seen coal before.
But should we be glad that it's gone?
Personally, yes.
Wow, you're the first ex-miner who's told me that.
That's it. I mean, I worked down there. My father, he died of pneumoconiosis. He worked 40 years at the same pit. But he, at the finish, he thought, well, coal's had its day.
Today, coal's legacy in British life is both fading and instrumental. You can see its legacy in pubs and cities and so much culture. This journey has taught me that that legacy is bittersweet for so many.
It underpinned the Industrial Revolution and these kind of rich, vibrant communities that built their own cultures.
We're a proud people, and our contribution to society has been unbelievable.
We clawed for coal. We built this country around coal, you mean?
Dan Ashby reported that story for the program Inside Europe from our partners at DW, Deutsche Welle. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We've been hearing about environmental challenges across the globe this hour. The stories and the picture of the future that they paint can be overwhelming. And maybe you're having some feelings about that. Don't worry, you are not alone. The World's Bianca Hillier reported in May this year on the impact of climate change on mental health and some of the ways people struggling with climate anxiety are working through it.
It's a rainy weeknight in Brooklyn, and a small group of people sit in a circle with mugs of tea and plates of popcorn in hand.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming. Max, I'll be the facilitator this evening.
The group shares names before getting into the meat of the conversation, climate and how they feel about it. The gathering is called a climate cafe. Attendees ask to go by their first names only, citing privacy concerns. For Matt, the rainy weather is top of mind.
Usually I'm very an optimistic person, but I'm definitely feeling like a day like today, rainy spring, kind of cool. It just makes me like extra concerned. When I think about the drought and wildfires, I'm like, is this the ground even going to absorb all this water and be able to help mitigate these things?
Another attendee, Benny, speaks next.
In all my actions throughout the day, there's an undercurrent of this grief that's saying, what's going to happen in 5 years? Is this going to be here?
Conversations like this are taking place at climate cafes across the globe.
The beauty of a climate cafe is that it can really be anywhere in the world.
Janine Walker hosted one at a university in central Vietnam.
It can be in your house, it can be in your backyard, it can be at the library. So there's no one way to have a climate cafe.
Walker works for an environmental nonprofit called Force of Nature, which has hosted nearly 200 climate cafes everywhere from Svalbard, Norway to Melbourne, Australia. She says the community element is crucial.
We live in a time of doom scrolling and people are very much spreading information about it's too late, like we've surpassed the temperature of no return. And it can just feel like a very isolating situation.
That's leading to real mental health issues, says Britt Ray, who researches the intersection of climate change and mental health at Stanford University. She says the global increase in what's called eco-anxiety makes a lot of sense.
We're dealing with a lot of loss. We're dealing with places becoming uninhabitable. So to feel some distress is a sign of our care and our love for all that is in harm's way.
Just like in other areas of life, Ray says it's important to pay attention to these emotions rather than shoving them down.
If we are not mindful about the ways that these emotions show up in their lives, we can potentially become trapped by them. We can actually have our agency be thwarted.
While eco-anxiety and climate anxiety can be serious, Ray says they're not pathological or diagnosable.
In most cases, it is subclinical, and it is simply a human experience of moving through some distressing thoughts and feelings. They don't need to be dismissed with a pill or given a diagnosis.
What they do need is to be acknowledged, and some people are doing that on stage.
Make it loud right now for Esteban Gass!
Esteban Gast is a Colombian-American comedian who jokes about climate change.
I was watching this movie with my fiance, and it said, it's 100 years from now. Half the humans are dead. And I genuinely looked at her, and I was like, that's pretty good. That was so... Half of us made it. Woo!
Gast hopes that by sharing his own eco-anxiety and fears, people in the audience feel a bit less alone. It's a tactic that has worked before.
Comedy has been used all of history to tackle the most serious things.
Another joke pokes fun at the politics around President Biden's climate-friendly Inflation Reduction Act.
I love that they were like trying to sell it, and they're like, should we save the earth? And people were like, too partisan. And they're like, should eggs cost less? And they're like, pass it!
Gast says his sets do well with students and at climate events, of course. But he's also received positive feedback from general audiences who may be less climate conscious on the whole.
People were like, that was funny. That was interesting. Hey, you made me think. Cool. I wish it were like a movie and someone said, wow, you really changed my heart and mind. But I think that I talked about things that they perhaps normally aren't talking about.
Researchers have also developed tools to explore eco-anxiety in a more structured way. At the University of Helsinki in Finland, Panu Pikala helped create the Climate Emotions Wheel.
The four words in the middle are broad titles.
Anger, positivity, fear, and sadness. Each one of those then splits into more nuanced feelings. For example, fear can manifest as panic, anxiety, or powerlessness. It's been translated into more than 30 languages, and there's an emoji version. Pikala says emotion wheels have a long history in psychology.
It's very helpful for people to see names of emotions, perhaps some colors also, some visualizations.
He says the wheel is mostly used by educators and therapists as a visual tool to guide conversations. Back at the Climate Cafe in Brooklyn, the group moves on from talking about their emotions to singing about them.
We shall not be moved just like a tree planted by the water.
The folk jam portion of the evening has the group singing folk songs focused on climate. They even rewrite some of the lyrics.
Crying out for justice, we shall not be moved. Crying out for justice, we shall not be moved, just like a tree.
They also play Pete Seeger's Sailing Up, Sailing Down.
The river may be dirty now, but it's getting cleaner every day.
Folk jams don't happen at every climate cafe, but Matt, who's leading this event, says it's a welcome and cathartic addition.
I've done things where you scream, you let things out, right? I think it's in a similar vein because the songs are climate focused, obviously, and it's usually optimistic, right? We're just singing the song, Pete Seeger talking about cleaning up the river. It's not doom and gloom, which so much of climate is, so, and rightfully so, but it's nice to be able to have that experience and end on a positive note, too.
Finding comfort amid the climate crisis, at least for a couple of hours. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Stopping all along the way. The river may be dirty now, but it's getting cleaner.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can catch up on our reporting online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend. The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just,
Verdant and Peaceful World, macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.